Hi, this is Mrs. English, and today I will be reading to you from Richmond Lattimore's translation of Homer's Odyssey. Richmond Lattimore's translation of Homer's Odyssey, and I'm reading from Book 4. They came into the cavernous hollow of Lake Daemon and made their way to the house of glorious Menelaus. They found him in his own house, giving, for many townsmen, a wedding feast for his son and stately daughter. The girl he was sending to the son of Achilles, breaker of battalions, for in Troy land first he had nodded his head to it and promised to give her. And now the gods were bringing to pass their marriage. So he was sending her on her way, with horses and chariots, to the famous city of the Myrmidons, where Neoptolemus, the son of Achilles, was lord. And he brought Alector's daughter from Sparta to give powerful Megapenthes, his young grown son born to him by a slave woman. But the gods gave no more children to Helen, once she had borne her first and only child, the lovely Hermione, with the beauty of Aphrodite the Golden. Line 15. So these neighbors and townsmen of glorious Menelaus were at their feasting all about the great house with the high roof and taking their ease, and among them stepped an inspired singer playing his lyre, while among the dancers two acrobats led the measures of song and dance revolving among them. These two now, line 20, the hero Telemachus and the shining son of Nestor in the forecourt, themselves and their horses stood, while powerful Eteoneus, who was the active henchman of glorious Menelaus, came forward and saw them and went with his message through the house to the shepherd of the people. Line 25. He came, and standing close beside him, addressed him in winged words. Menelaus, dear to Zeus, here are certain strangers, two men, and they look like the breed of great Zeus. Tell me then whether we should unharness their fast horses or send them on to somebody else who can entertain them. So the henchman says to Menelaus, do you want to see your guests, or do you want me to send him on somewhere else since we're having a wedding feast? Line 30. Then, deeply vexed, fair-haired Menelaus answered him, Eteoneus, son of Boethus, you were never a fool before, but now you're babbling nonsense as a child would do. Surely we too have eaten much hospitality from other men before we came back here. May Zeus only make an end of such misery hereafter. Unharness the strangers' horses then, and bring them in here to be feasted. So he spoke, and the man hurried through the hall, bestirring the other active henchmen to come on the way along with him. They set free the sweating horses from under the harness, line 40, and tethered them fast by the reins in front of the horse mangers, and put down fodder before them and mixed white millet into it, and leaned the chariots up against the glittering inner walls, and led the men inside the divine house. These marveled as they admired the palace of the king whom Zeus loved. 45. For as the shining of the sun or the moon was the shining all through this high-roofed house of glorious Menelaus, when with their eyes they had had their pleasure and admiration, they stepped into the bathtubs, smooth-polished, and bathed there. Then, when the maids had bathed them and anointed them with oil, line 50, and put cloaks of thick fleece and tunics upon them, they went and sat on chairs beside Menelaus, the son of Atreus. A maid-servant brought water for them and poured it from a splendid and golden pitcher, holding it above a silver basin for them to wash, and she pulled a polished table before them. A grave housekeeper brought in the bread and served it to them, adding many good things to it, generous with her provisions, while a carver lifted platters of all kinds of meat and set them in front of them and placed beside them the golden goblets. Then in greeting, fair-haired Menelaus said to them, line 60, help yourselves to the food and welcome, and then afterward, when you have tasted dinner, we shall ask you who among men you are, for the stock of your parents can be no lost one, but you are of the race of men who are kings, whom Zeus sustains, who bear scepters. No mean men, no common men, could have such sons as you are. And here, of course, we see Menelaus practicing perfect hospitality, perfect xenia. So he spoke, line 65, and taking in his hands the fat beef loin which had been given as his choice portion, he set it before them. So not only does Menelaus bathe them, take care of their needs, feeds their horses, mixing extra special goodies in with their horses, took care of their chariots, takes his own special portion of the beef, and puts it before his guests. They put their hands to the good things that lay ready before them. But when they had put away their desire for eating and drinking, then Telemachus talked to the son of Nestor, leaning his head close to his, line 70, so that none of the others might hear him. "Son of Nestor, you who delight to my heart, only look at the gleaming of the bronze all through these echoing mansions, and the gleaming of gold and amber, of silver and of ivory. The court of Zeus on Olympus must be like this on the inside. Such abundance of everything. Wonder takes me as I look on it." Menelaus of the fair hair overheard him speaking, and now he spoke to both of them and addressed them in winged words. "Dear children, there is no mortal who could rival Zeus. Seeing that his mansions are immortal and his possessions, there may be some man, line 80, who could rival me for property, or there may be none. Much did I suffer and wandered much before bringing all this home in my ships when I came back in the 8th year. I wandered to Cyprus and Phoenicia, to the Egyptians. I reached the Ethiopians, Erimboi, Sidonians, and Libya, where the rams grow their horns quickly. 3 times in the fulfillment of a year their sheep flocks give birth. And there no lord would ever go wanting, and go without, go lacking, nor would his shepherd for cheese or meat, nor for the sweet milk either, but always the sheep yield a continuous supply for their sucklings. Line 90. But while I was wandering those parts and bringing together much property, meanwhile another man killed my brother secretly, by surprise and by his cursed wife's treachery. And of course, here Menelaus is speaking of Agamemnon. So it is with no pleasure I am lord over all these possessions. You will have heard all this from your fathers, whoever your fathers are, for I have suffered much, and destroyed a household that was very strongly settled, and held many goods within it. I wish I lived in my house with only a third part of all these goods, and that the men were alive who died in those days in wide Troy land, far away from horse-pasturing Argus. Line 100. Still and again lamenting all these men and sorrowing, many a time when I'm sitting here in our palace I will indulge my heart in sorrow, and then another time give over, for surfeit of gloomy lamentation comes quickly. But for none of all these, sorry as I am, do I grieve so much as for one who makes hateful for me my food and my sleep when I remember, since no one of the Achaeans labored so much as Odysseus labored and achieved. And for him the end was grief for him, and for me a sorrow that is never forgotten for his sake. How he has gone so long, and we knew nothing of whether he is alive or dead. Line 110. The aged Laertes, the father of Odysseus, and temperate Penelope, the wife of Odysseus, must surely be grieving for him, with little Telemachus, whom he left behind in his house, a young child, who of course is going on 20 now. He spoke, and stirred in the other the longing to weep for his father. And the tears fell from his eyes to the ground when he heard his father's name, holding with both hands the robe that was stained with purple up before his eyes. And Menelaus perceived it, and now he pondered 2 ways within, in mind and in spirit, whether he would leave it to him to name his father, or whether he should speak first and ask and inquire about everything. Line 120. While he was pondering these things in his heart and his spirit, Helen came out of her fragrant high-roofed bedchamber, looking like Artemis of the golden distaff. Adreste followed and set the well-made chair in place for her, and the coverlet of soft wool was carried in by Alcippe, and Philo brought the silver workbasket, which had been given by Alcandra, the wife of Polybus, who lived in Egyptian Thebes, where the greatest number of goods are stored in the houses. Polybus himself gave Menelaus 2 silver bathtubs, and a pair of tripods, and 10 talents of gold, and apart from these, his wife gave her own beautiful gifts to Helen. She gave her a golden distaff and a basket, silver with wheels underneath, and the edges were done in gold. Philo, her maidservant, now brought it in, and set it beside her full of yarn that had been prepared for spinning. The distaff, with the dark-colored wool, was laid over the basket. Helen seated herself on the chair, and under her feet was a footstool. At once she spoke to her husband and questioned him about everything. "Do we know, Menelaus, beloved of Zeus, who these men announce themselves as being, who have come into our house now?" Line 140. "Shall I be wrong, or am I speaking the truth? My heart tells me to speak, for I think I never saw such a likeness, neither in man nor woman, and wonder takes me as I look on him, as this man has a likeness to the son of great-hearted Odysseus. Telemachus, who was left behind in his house, a young child, by that man, when for the sake of shameless me, the Achaeans went beneath Troy, their hearts intent upon reckless warfare. Then, in answer, fair-haired Menelaus said to her, I also see it thus, my wife, the way you compare them, for Odysseus's feet were like this man's, his hands were like this, line 150, and the glances of his eyes and his head and hair growing. Now, too, I was remembering things about Odysseus and spoke of him, what misery he had in his hard work for me, and he let fall a heavy tear from under his eyelids, holding before his eyes the robe that was stained with purple. Line 155. Now Pisistratus, son of Nestor, spoke up before him. Great Menelaus, son of Atreus, leader of the people, this is in truth the son of that man, just as you are saying, but he is modest, and his spirit would be shocked at the thought of coming here and beginning a show of reckless language in front of you, for we both delight in your voice as if a god were speaking. In this way, Pisistratus, Nestor's son, covers for Telemachus that he's unable to speak. The Geranian horseman, Nestor, sent me to go along with him and escort him. He longed to see you so that you could advise him somewhat, for word or action. For a child endures many griefs in his house when his father is gone away, and no others are there to help him, as now Telemachus's father is gone away, and there are no others who can defend him against the evil that is in his country. Then in answer, fair-haired Menelaus said to him, See now, this is the son of a man greatly beloved who has come now into my house, line 170, one who for my sake endured many trials, and I thought he would come and would love him beyond all other Argives, if only Olympian Zeus of the wide brows granted both of us to come home across the sea in our fast ships. I would have settled a city in Argos for him and made him a home, bringing him from Ithaca with all his possessions, his son, all his people. I would have emptied one city for him out of those that are settled round about and under my lordship. And both here we would have seen much of each other. Nothing would then have separated us two in our friendship and pleasure, until the darkening cloud of death had shrouded us over. Line 180. All this must be what the very God himself begrudged him, who made only him an unhappy man without a homecoming. He spoke, and started in all of them the desire for weeping. Helen of Argos, daughter of Zeus, wept. So too Telemachus wept, line 185, as did Menelaus the son of Atreus. Nor did Nestor's son Pisistratus have eyes altogether tearless, for he was thinking in his heart of stately Antilochus, one whom the glorious son of the shining dawn had cut down. It was of him he thought as he addressed them in winged words. Line 190. Son of Atreus, the aged Nestor used to say you were thoughtful, surpassing other men when we spoke about you there in his own palace, and when we questioned each other. So now, if it may be, would you do me a favor? For my part, I have no joy in tears after dinner time. There will always be a new dawn tomorrow. Yet I can have no objection to tears for any mortal who dies and goes to his destiny, and this is the only consolation we wretched mortals can give, to cut our hair and let the tears roll down our faces. For I myself had a brother who died. He was not the meanest, the most common, of the Argives, and you would have known him, but I, for my part, never met nor saw him. They say he surpassed all others. Antilochus, surpassingly swift of foot and a fighter. So here poor Nestor's son, Pisistratus, is looking for any information on his dead brother. He just wants to know what his brother was like. Then in answer, fair-haired Menelaus said to him, Dear friend, since you have said all that a man who is thoughtful could say or do, line 205, even one who was older than you are, why, this is the way your father is. So you too speak thoughtfully. Easily recognized is the line of that man, for whom Cronos's son weaves good fortune in his marrying and begetting, as now he has given to Nestor all his days, for himself to grow old prosperously in his own palace, and also that his sons should be clever and excellent in the spear's work. Now we shall let the weeping be. That came to us just now, and let us think again about dinner. Let someone pour us water for our hands, and there will be a time for words tomorrow at dawn, for Telemachus and me to talk with each other. He spoke, and Asphalion, who was the active henchman of glorious Menelaus, poured water for them to wash with. They put their hands to the good things that lay ready before them. Now Helen, who was descended of Zeus, thought of the next thing. Line 220. Into the wine. Oh, isn't this considerate of Helen? Into the wine of which they were drinking, she cast a medicine of heartsease, free of gall, to make one forget all sorrows. And whoever had drunk it down once it had been mixed in the wine bowl, for the day that he drank it would have no tear roll down his face, not if his mother died and his father died, not if men murdered a brother or a beloved son in his presence with the bronze, and he with his own eyes saw it. Such were the subtle medicines Zeus's daughter had in her possessions, good things, and given to her by the wife of Thon, Polydamna of Egypt, where the fertile earth produces the greatest number of medicines, many good in mixture, many malignant, and every man is a doctor there, and more understanding than men elsewhere. So Helen came back from Egypt with the possession of drugs. These people are of the race of Paean. Now when she had put the medicine in and told them to pour it, taking up the story again, she began to speak to them. Line 235. Son of Atreus, dear to Zeus, Menelaus, and you who are here, children of noble fathers, yet divine Zeus sometimes gives out good, or sometimes evil. He can do anything. Sit here now in the palace and take your dinner, and listen to me and be entertained, and I might add, have another drink. What I will tell you is plausible. Line 240. I could not tell you all the number, nor could I name them, all that make up the exploits of enduring Odysseus. But here is a task such as that strong man endured and accomplished in the Trojan country, where you Achaeans suffered miseries. He flagellated himself with degrading strokes, then threw on a worthless sheet about his shoulders. He looked like a servant. So Helen's telling them a story of something Odysseus did. He flagellated, he beat himself up with like a whip, then put a worthless sheet on his shoulders. He looked like a servant. Line 245. So he crept into the wide-wayed city of the men he was fighting, disguising himself in the likeness of somebody else, a beggar, a one who was unlike himself beside the ships of the Achaeans, but in his likeness crept into the Trojans' city, and they all were taken in. I alone recognized him, even in this form, and I questioned him, but he in his craftiness eluded me. But after I had bathed him and anointed him with olive oil and put some clothing upon him, after I had sworn a great oath not to disclose before the Trojans that this was Odysseus, line 255, until he had made his way back to the fast ships and the shelters, then at last he told me all the purpose of the Achaeans, and after striking many Trojans down with the thin bronze edge, he went back to the Argives and brought back much information. So Odysseus came in as a spy. The rest of the Trojan women cried out shrill, but my heart was happy, line 260. My heart had changed by now and was for going back home again, and I grieved for the madness that Aphrodite bestowed when she led me there away from my own dear country, forsaking my own daughter, my bedchamber, and my husband, a man who lacked no endowment, either of brains or beauty. Line 265. Then in answer, fair-haired Menelaus said to her, Yes, my wife, all this that you said is fair and orderly. In my time I've studied the wit and counsel of many men who are heroes, and I've been over much of the world, yet nowhere have I seen with my eyes anyone like him, nor known an inward heart like the heart of enduring Odysseus. Here is the way that strong man acted, and the way he endured action. And now we have another story. Menelaus will tell one. This is how we find out the wanderings of Odysseus. It will all be told in flashback. Telemachus journeys around, and people tell stories about his father. Inside the wooden horse, where we, who were the greatest of the Argives, all were sitting and bringing death and destruction to the Trojans, then you came there, Helen. You will have been moved by some divine spirit who wished to grant glory to the Trojans, and Deiphobus, a godlike man, was with you when you came. Three times you walked around the hollow ambush, feeling it, and you called out, naming them by name to the best of the Danaans, and made your voice sound like the wife of each of the Argives. So they're hiding in the horse, and they're inside Troy, all the best of the Argives. Helen comes, walks around the horse three times, calling out to each of the men that she knows must be inside, the greatest heroes, and she has the ability to use the voice of their wives as she calls out, trying to trick them to say that they are there. Line 280. Now I myself and the son of Tydeus and great Odysseus were sitting there in the middle of them, and we heard you crying aloud, And Diomedes and I started up, both minded to go outside, or else to answer your voice from inside. But Odysseus pulled us back and held us for all our eagerness. Then all the other sons of the Achaeans were silent. There was only one. It was Anticlus who was ready to answer, but Odysseus, brutally squeezing his mouth in the clutch of his powerful hands, held him, and so saved the lives of all the Achaeans until such time as Pallas Athena led you off from us. Line 290. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to him in answer, "Great Menelaus, son of Atreus, leader of the people, so much the worse, for none of all this kept dismal destruction from him, not even if he had a heart of iron within him. But come, let us take us away to our beds, so that at last now we can go to bed and enjoy the pleasure of sweet sleep." So he spoke, and Helen of Argos told her serving maids to make up beds in the porch's shelter, and to lay upon them fine underbedding of purple, and spread blankets above it, and fleecy robes to be an over-all covering. The maidservants went forth from the main house, and in their hands held torches, so and they made the beds. The guests were led outside by a herald. So the hero Telemachus and the glorious son of Nestor slept in the place outside the house in the porch's shelter, but the son of Atreus slept in the inner room of the high house, and by him lay Helen of the light robes, shining among women. Line 305. And now when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, when the sun came up, Menelaus of the great war cry rose from where he was sleeping and put on his clothes, and slung a sharp sword over his shoulder. Underneath his shining feet he bound the fair sandals and went on his way from the chamber, like a god in presence, and sat down by Telemachus and spoke to him and named him. "What is the need that has brought you here, O hero Telemachus, to shining Lake Demone over the sea's wide ridges? A private or a public matter? Tell me this truly." Line 315. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to him in answer, "Great Menelaus, son of Atreus, leader of the people, I've come to see if you could tell me some news of my father, for my home has been eaten away, the rich fields are ruined, and the house is full of hateful men, who now forever slaughter my crowding sheep and lumbering horn-curved cattle, these suitors of my mother overbearing in their rapacity. That is why I come to your knees now, in case you might wish to tell me of his dismal destruction, whether you saw it perhaps with your own eyes, or heard the tale from another who wandered too. His mother bore this man to be wretched. Do not soften it, because you pity me and are sorry for me, but fairly tell me all that your eyes have witnessed. I implore you, if ever noble Odysseus, my father, undertook any kind of word or work and fulfilled it for you, in the land of the Trojans, where all you Achaeans suffered, tell me these things from your memory, and tell me the whole truth." Then, deeply angered, fair-haired Menelaus said to him, "Oh, for shame! It was in the bed of a bold and strong man they wished to lie, they themselves being all unwarlike." And, of course, he's talking about the suitors. Line 335. "As when a doe has brought her fawns to the lair of a lion and put them there to sleep, they are newborn and still suckling, then wanders out into the foothills and grassy corners, grazing there. But now the lion comes back to his own lair and visits a shameful destruction on both mother and children. So Odysseus will visit shameful destruction on these men." Line 340. "O Father Zeus and Athena and Apollo, I wish that as he was when upon a time in strong-founded Lesbos, he stood up and wrestled Palamedes from a challenge and threw him strongly, so delighting all the Achaeans, I wish that such an Odysseus would come now among the suitors. They all would find death was quick and marriage a painful matter. But for what you entreat me for and ask me about, I will not turn away from the tale and speak idly, nor will I deceive you. But of what the ever-truthful old man of the sea told me, I will tell all without concealment, and hold back nothing." That was line 350. Oh. "The gods held me still in Egypt when I was eager to come back here, for I had not rendered complete hecatombs to them. The gods have always desired that their orders should be listened to. There is an island there in the heavy wash of the open sea in front of Egypt, and they call it Pharos, as far out as the distance a hollow ship can make in a whole day's sailing, when a sharp and following wind is blowing it onward. And there is a harbor there with good anchorage, whence they put forth their balanced ships to sea, after they have drawn dark water. There the gods held me 20 days, line 360, nor did the sea winds ever appear and blow across the salt water such winds as act to send ships sailing over the sea's wide ridges. And now the food would have all been gone, and the men's strength with it, if one of the gods had not been sorry for me and shown mercy. Eidothea, daughter to mighty Proteus, the old man of the sea, for it was her heart that I moved mostly when she met me wandering by myself, without my companions. For always ranging about the island, they would go fishing with crooked fish hooks, and always the hunger oppressed their bellies. Line 370. She came and stood close beside me and spoke a word and addressed me. Are you so simple then, O stranger, and flimsy-minded, or are you willingly giving up and enjoying your hardships? See, you are held so long on the island, and can find no way out of it, while the heart in your companions diminishes. So she spoke, line 375, and I in turn spoke up and made answer. So I will tell, whoever you may be of the goddesses, that I am not detained of my own free will, but it must be I have offended the immortals who hold wide heaven. But do you then tell me, for the gods know everything, which one of the immortals hampers me here and keeps me from my journey, and tell me how to make my way home on the sea, where the fish swarm. So I spoke, and she, shining among the goddesses, answered, See, I will accurately answer all that you ask me. The ever-truthful old man of the sea ranges in these parts. This is the Egyptian immortal Proteus, and he knows all the depths of the sea. He is Poseidon's underthing, and they say also he is my father, that he begot me. If somehow you could lie in ambush and catch hold of him, he could tell you the way to go, the stages of your journey, line 390, and tell you how to make your way home on the sea where the fish swarm. And he could tell you too, O illustrious one, if you wish it, what evil and what good has been done in your place while you've been gone away on your long and arduous voyage. So she spoke, but then I answered her and said to her, Show me the way to lie in wait for this divine ancient, for fear he may somehow see me first and be warned and avoid me. A god is difficult for a mortal man to master. So I spoke, and she, shining among goddesses, answered, See, I will accurately answer all that you ask me. Line 400. At the time when the sun has gone up to bestride the middle of heaven, then the ever-truthful old man of the sea will come out of the water under the blast of the west wing, circled in a shudder of darkening water, and when he comes out he will sleep under hollow caverns, and around him seals, those darlings of the sea's lovely lady, sleep in a huddle after they have emerged from the gray sea, giving off the sour smell that comes from the deep salt water. There I will take you myself when dawn shows and arrange you orderly in your ambush. You must choose from your companions those three who are your best beside your strong-benched vessels. Line 410. So when he comes up for his nap at noon, you can get him. You lie in wait at dawn. Now I will tell you all the devious ways of this old man. First of all, he will go among his seals and count them. But after he has reviewed them all and noted their number, he will lie down in their midst like a herdsman among his sheepfolds. Next, as soon as you see that he is asleep, that will be the time for all of you to use your strength and your vigor and hold him there while he strives and struggles hard to escape you. And he will try you by taking the form of all creatures that come forth and move on the earth. He will be water and magical fire. So the old man of the sea is a shape-changer. You must hold stiffly on to him and squeeze him the harder, line 420. But when at last he himself, speaking in words, questions you, being now in the same form he was when you saw him sleeping, then, hero, you must give over your force and let the old man go free, and ask him which one of the gods is angry with you, and ask him how to make your way home on the sea where the fish swarm. So she spoke, and dived back into the surf of the water. Then I, and of course Menelaus is speaking here, then I went back again to our ships, where they were stationed along the sand, but my heart was a storm in me as I went. Now, when I had come back to where my ship lay by the seaside, we made ready our dinner, and the immortal night came over, and then we lay down to sleep along the break of the sea beach. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, when the sun came up, then I made my way along the beach of the wide-waved sea, praying much to the gods, and I took along with me those three companions I trusted most for any adventure. Line 435. Meanwhile, she had dived down into the sea's great cavern and brought back the skins of four seals out of the water. All were newly skinned. She was planning a trick on her father, And hollowing out four beds in the sand of the sea, she sat there waiting for us, and we came close up to her. Thereupon she bedded us down in order and spread a skin over each man. That was a most awful ambush. And remember, this is Menelaus talking to his guests, telling a story of his way home from Troy when he got stuck at Egypt. That was a most awful ambush, for the pernicious smell of those seals bred in the salt water oppressed us terribly. So there they are lying in four, you know, body-sized ditches with newly skinned seal skins on top of them that stink. But who would want to lie down to sleep by a sea-bred monster? But she herself came to our rescue and devised a great help. She brought ambrosia, line 445, and put it under the nose of each man, and it smelled very sweet, and did away with the stench of the monster. All that morning we waited there with enduring spirit, and the seals came crowding out of the sea, and when they came out there, they lay down to sleep in order along the break of the sea beach. At noon, the old man came out of the sea and found his well-fed seals and went about to them all and counted their number, and we were among the first he counted. He had no idea of any treachery. Then he, too, lay down among us. We, with a cry, sprang up and rushed on to him, locking him in our arms. But the old man, line 455, did not forget the subtlety of his arts. First he turned into a great bearded lion, and then to a serpent, then to a leopard, then to a great boar, and he turned into fluid water, to a tree with flowering branches, but we held stiffly on to him with endearing spirit. Line 460. But when the old man, versed in devious ways, grew weary of all this, he spoke to me in words and questioned me. Which of the gods now, son of Atreus, has been advising you to capture me from ambush against my will? What do you want? So he spoke, and I in turn spoke up and made answer. So this is Menelaus speaking to the old man of the sea. You know, old man, why try to put me off with your answer? See, I am held so long on the island and can find no way out of it while the inward heart in me diminishes. Do you then tell me, for the gods know everything, which one of the immortals hampers me here and keeps me from my journey, and tell me how to make my way home on the sea where the fish swarm? So I spoke, and he in turn spoke up and made answer. But you should have made grand sacrifices to Zeus and the other immortal gods, and so gone on board, so most quickly to reach your own country, sailing over the wine-blue water. Line 475. It is not your destiny now to see your own people and come back to your strong-founded house and to the land of your fathers, until you have gone back once again to the water of Egypt, the sky-fallen river, and there have accomplished holy hecatombs in honor of all the immortal gods who hold wide heaven. Then the gods will grant you that journey that you so long for. So he spoke, and the inward heart in me was broken, because he ordered me to go back on the misty surface of the water to Egypt again, a long way and a hard one. But even so I answered him in words and said to him, All these things I will do, old man, this line 485, in the way you tell me. But come now, tell me this and give me an accurate answer. Do all those Achaeans Nestor and I left behind when we went sailing from Troy, did all those, did they come back in their ships? Without injury, or did any of them die a dismal death on shipboard, or in the arms of his friends after he had wound up in the fighting? So I spoke. So that's the last thing Menelaus asks the old man in the sea. First, how do I get home? He has to go back to Egypt and offer a hecatomb, then he'll be able to get home. Now, while he's got the old man in the sea, he says, Tell me about all those guys I left behind. Did they get home? Line 491. So I spoke, and he in turn spoke up and made answer. Son of Atreus, why did you ask me that? You should not learn it, nor know what my mind knows, and I think you will not be free of tears for long once you have heard the whole story. There were many of these men who were lost, and many left over, but two alone, who were leaders of the bronze-armored Achaeans, died on the way home. You yourself were there at the fighting, and there is one who is being held alive on the wide sea somewhere. Aias was lost, and his long-oared vessels with him. Line 500. First of all, Poseidon drove him against the great rocks at Gyrae, and yet he saved him out of the water, and Aias would have escaped his doom, though Athena hated him, had he not gone wildly mad and tossed out a word of defiance, for he said that in despite of the gods he escaped the great gulf of the sea, and Poseidon heard him loudly vaunting, and at once, with his ponderous hands catching up the trident, He drove it against the Gyrian rock and split a piece of it, and part of it stayed where it was, but a splinter crashed in the water, and this was where Aias had been perched when he raved so madly. So Aias was almost drowned. When he did not drown, he bragged that he saved himself, and that made Poseidon so mad that he just knocked the piece of rock Aias was standing on off. Line 510. It carried him down to the depths of the endless and tossing main sea. So Aias died when he had swallowed down the salt water. And of course, this means no burial. Your brother somehow got away and escaped the death spirits with his hollow ships. And of course, who's that? Agamemnon. It was the Lady Hera who saved him. But now, as he had come close to the point of making the sheer peak, Melea, then the storm winds caught him away and carried him, groaning heavily, out on the open sea where the fish swarm. But since even from out there an easy homecoming was manifest for him, the gods twisted the wind back, and they made the homeland at the uttermost edge of his estate, where before now Thyestes had made his home, but now Aegisthus, son of Thyestes, lived. Agamemnon stepped rejoicing on the soul of it. Soil of his country, and stroked the ground with his hand and kissed it, and his thronging hot tears streamed down, so dear to him was the sight of his country. But a watchman saw him from his lookout, a man whom Aegisthus had treacherously taken and stationed there, and promised him 2 talents of gold as pay. A diversion here. You know what happens to Agamemnon when he comes home. This is the way the play Agamemnon opens, with a watchman lying on the roof of Agamemnon's house, Clytemnestra ruling there with Agamemnon's cousin Aegisthus, and the watchman says, "They're home." For a year he had been watching, so Agamemnon would not go by unnoticed and mindful of his furious valor. The man ran to the house of the warlord with his news, and at once Aegisthus, Agamemnon's cousin, who did not go to Troy, devised a treacherous stratagem. Line 530. Choosing out the 20 best fighting men in the district, he set an ambush, and beside it had them arrange a festival, and went down to welcome Agamemnon, shepherd of the people, with horses and chariots, and with shameful thoughts in his mind. Then led him in, all unsuspicious of death, and feasted him, and killed him feasting, as one strikes down an ox at his manger. Not one of Agamemnon's men who followed him was left alive, nor one of Aegisthus's men. All were killed in the palace. So he spoke. And of course, this is Menelaus speaking again. So he spoke, talking about the old man in the sea, telling the story. So he spoke, and the inward heart in me was broken. And I sat down on the sand and cried. Nor did the heart in me wish to go on living any longer, nor to look on the sunlight. But when I had glutted myself with rolling on the sand and weeping, then the ever-truthful old man of the sea said to me, "No longer now, son of Atreus, spend your time on these wasting tears, for I know no good that will come of it. Rather, with all speed, endeavor to make good your way back to the land of your fathers. You might find Aegisthus still alive, or perhaps Orestes has beaten you to the kill, but you might be there for the burying." So he spoke, so the old man in the sea spoke, and this is Menelaus telling the story to Telemachus. So he spoke, and the heart within me and the proud spirit of the breast were softened, even though I was so sorrowful. And now I spoke aloud to him and addressed him in winged words, because Menelaus just found out his brother Agamemnon was killed when he went home. "These then I know," line 551, "but do you tell me the name of the third man, whoever it is who is being held alive on the wide sea, or else he has died? But for all my sorrow I would hear this." So I spoke, and he in turn spoke up and made answer. Line 555. "That was Odysseus, son of Laertes, who makes his home in Ithaca, whom I saw on an island weeping big tears in the palace of the nymph Calypso. And she detains him by constraint, and he cannot make his way to his country, for he has not any ships by him, nor any companions who can convey him back across the sea's wide ridges. But for you, Menelaus, O fostered of Zeus, is it not the gods' will that you shall die and go to your end in horse-pasturing Argus? But the immortals will convey you to the Elysian field, and the limits of the earth where fair-haired Rhadamanthes is, and where there is made the easiest life for mortals. For there is no snow, nor much winter there, nor is there ever rain, but always the stream of the ocean sends up breezes of the west wind, blowing briskly for the refreshment of mortals. Why does Menelaus not have to go down to the underworld? Why does he get to go to the Elysian fields? This, because Helen is yours, and you are son-in-law, therefore, to Zeus. He spoke and dived back into the tossing deep water. But I went back again to my ships, and my godlike companions went with me. But my heart was a storm in me as I went. Now, when we had come back to where our ship lay by the seaside, we made ready our dinner, and the immortal night came over. Line 575. And then we lay down to sleep along the break of the sea beach. But when the young dawn showed again with her rosy fingers, first of all we dragged the ship down into the bright water, and in the balanced ships set the masts in place and set sails, and we ourselves also went aboard and sat to the oarlocks, and sitting well in order we dashed the oars into the gray sea, back to where Egypt is, the sky-fallen river, and there I stranded my ships, and there I rendered complete hecatombs. But when I had ended the anger of the gods, who are everlasting, I piled a mound for Agamemnon, so that his memory might never die. I did this and set sail, and the immortals gave me a wind, so brought me back to my own dear country with all speed. Come now, stay here with me in my palace, until it is the 11th day, and even the 12th day, and then I will send you well on your way, and give you glorious gifts, 3 horses and a well-finished chariot. Also, I will give you a fine goblet, so that you can pour libations to the immortals, and think of me all your days when you do so. Then the thoughtful Telemachus said to him in answer, Son of Atreus, do not keep me with you here for a long time, since I could well be satisfied to sit here beside you for a year's time, without any longing for home or parents. Such strange pleasure do I take listening to your stories and sayings, and being drugged by your wife. But by now my companions in sacred Pylos are growing restless, yet for some time you would keep me with you. He left his companions in sacred Pylos with Nesta, remember? Line 600. And let the gift you give me be something that can be stored up. I will not take the horses to Ithaca, but will leave them here for your own delight. Since you are lord of a spreading plain, there's plenty of clover here, there is galingale, and there is wheat and millet here, and white barley, wide grown. There are no wide courses in Ithaca. There is no meadow, a place to feed goats, but lovelier than a place to feed horses, for there is no one of the islands that has meadows for driving horses. They are all sea slopes, and Ithaca more than all the others. He spoke, and Menelaus of the great war cry smiled on him. Line 610. And stroked him with his hand, and called him by name, and spoke to him, You are of true blood, dear child, in the way you reason. So I shall change all this for you, since I am able to, and of all those gifts that lie stored away in my house, I will give you the one which is most splendid and esteemed at the highest value. I will give you a fashioned mixing bowl. It is of silver all but the edges, and these are finished in gold. This is the work of Hephaestus. The hero Phidimus, the Sidonians' king, gave it to me when his house took me in and sheltered me there on my way home. I would give it to you for a present. So Menelaus will give Telemachus, a Xenia, a gift, a present that was also given to him as a guest present. Line 620. So these two remained conversing this way together, and the banqueters came now into the divine king's palace, and they drove sheep and carried heartening wine, and with them their wives in handsome hoods brought food along. In this way they about the palace were busy preparing dinner. But meanwhile, before the palace of Odysseus, the suitors amused themselves with... So now, meanwhile, if you could place a 1.5-inch space in your book between lines 624 and 625, meanwhile, and realize we have just changed scenes. But meanwhile, before the palace of Odysseus, the suitors amused themselves with discs and with light spears for throwing on a leveled floor, unruly men as they always had been. But Antinous and Eurymachus, the godlike, were seated as lords of the suitors, out and away the best men among them. And to them now came Phronius's son, Naoman, approaching Antinous, and spoke to him and asked him a question. Antinous, do we have an idea in our minds, or do we not, when Telemachus will come back from Sandy Pylos? Okay, do we know when he's coming back? He has gone and taken my ship, and now I find that I need her for crossing over to spacious Ellis, where I have a dozen horses, mares, and suckling from them, hard-working, unbroken mules. I would like to break one in, taking it from the others." So he spoke, and they were amazed at heart. They had not thought he had gone to Pylos, the city of Neleus, but that he was somewhere near on his lands, among the flocks, or else with the swineherd. It was Antinous, the son of Iphites, that answered, "Tell me the truth now. When did he go, and which of the young men went with him? The choice men of Ithaca, or were they his own following, henchmen and servants? Even he could accomplish so much." Line 645. "And tell me this, and tell me truly, so I can be certain. Did he take your black ship from you by force, when you were unwilling, or did you willingly give it to him when he spoke to you for it?" Then the son of Naoman, Phronius, gave him an answer. "I gave it to him of my free will. What else could one do when a man like this, with so many cares to trouble his spirit, asked for it? It would be hard to deny him the giving, and the young men who are going along with him are the noblest in our neighborhood. Also, I saw going aboard as leader, mentor, or it was a god, but he was in every way like him, and yet I wonder," line 655, "for yesterday early I saw the splendid mentor here, before he was boarding a ship for Pylos." So he spoke and went away to the house of his father, and the proud heart in both these suitors was filled with amazement. They had the suitors sit down in a group and stopped their contests. Line 660. "It was Antinous, the son of Iphites, who spoke to them, raging, the heart within filled black to the brim with anger from beneath, but his two eyes showed like fire in their blazing. Here now is a monstrous thing, this voyage made by Telemachus and insolently put through. We thought he would never achieve it. A young boy, and despite of so many of us, has hauled down his ship and gone away, choosing out the best men in the country. The evil will begin to go further. May Zeus grant destruction of the life in him before he comes to full measure of manhood. But come now, give me a fast ship and 20 companions, so that I can watch his return and lie in wait for him in a narrow strait between Ithaca and towering Samos, and make him sorry for this sea-going in search of his father." So he spoke, and they all approved what he said and urged, and at once they stood up and went inside the house of Odysseus. Line 675. Nor did Penelope go for a long time without knowing of the counsels which the suitors had been secretly planning, for Medon the herald told her, having overheard their counsels. He had been standing outside the court while they plotted inside it, and he went on his way with the message into the house of Penelope. Penelope spoke to him as he stepped over the threshold. "Herald! On what errand have the proud suitors sent you? Is it to tell the serving maids of godlike Odysseus to stop their work so as to prepare the suitors a dinner? Could this not be the last and the latest time of their dining here, whether coming to court me or meeting for some other reason? You, who keep gathering here and consuming away much livelihood, the property of wise Telemachus, nor have you listened to what you heard from your fathers before you, when you were children, what kind of a man Odysseus was among your own parents. How he did no act and spoke no word in his own country that was unfair, and that is a way divine kings have. One will be hateful to a certain man and favor another, but Odysseus was never outrageous at all to any man. But in you the spirit is plain to see, and your unjust actions, how you have no gratitude thereafter for good things done you." Medon, in turn, a man of thoughtful mind, said to her, "If only, my queen, that could be the worst of the evil. But the suitors now are devising another thing that is much worse and harder to bear. May the son of Cronos not see it accomplished. Now they're minded to kill Telemachus with the sharp bronze on his way home. He went in quest of news of his father to Pylos the sacrosanct and to glorious Lake Daemon." So he spoke, and her knees gave way and the heart in her. She stayed a long time without a word, speechless, and her eyes filled with tears. The springing voice was held still within her. At long last she found her words to speak to him in answer. "Herald, why is my child gone from me? There was no reason for him to board fast-running ships, which serve as horses for men on the salt sea, and they cross the expanse of water. Must it be so," line 710, "that even his name shall be gone from men's minds?" Medon then, a thoughtful man, spoke to her in answer, "I do not know whether some god moved him, or whether his own mind had the impulse to go to Pylos, in order to find out about his father's homecoming, or what fate he had met with." Line 715. So speaking, he went away back into the house of Odysseus, and a cloud of heart-wasting sorrow was on her. She had no strength left to sit down in a chair, though there were many there in the palace, but sat down on the floor of her own well-wrought bedchamber, weeping pitifully, and about her maids were wailing all who were there in the house with her, both young and old ones. To them, weeping constantly, Penelope spoke now. "Hear me, dear friends. The Olympian has given me sorrows beyond all others who were born and brought up together with me. For first I lost a husband with the heart of a lion, and who among the Danaans surpassed in all virtues, and great, whose fame, Hes Kleos, goes wide through Hellas and midmost Argus. And now again the storm winds have caught away my beloved son, without trace from the halls, and I never heard when he left me. Hard-hearted, not one out of you all then remembered to wake me out of my bed, though your minds knew all clearly when he went out and away to board the hollow black ship. For if I heard that he was considering this journey, then he would have had to stay, though hastening to his voyage, or he would have had to leave me dead in the halls. So now, let someone make her way quickly and summon the old man, Dolios, my own servant, whom my father gave me to have as I came here, and he keeps an orchard full of trees for me, so that he may go with speed to Laertes and sit beside him and tell him all, and perhaps he, weaving out the design in his heart, may go outside and complain to the people of those who are striving to waste away his own seed and that of godlike Odysseus." What is the only thing Penelope is able to do? She says, "Go get the man who's my servant alone, who keeps my orchard. Send him to my father, Laertes. Tell him the whole plot. Maybe my father, Laertes, can go to the men in the city and convince them how reckless this is, and perhaps Telemachus will not be ambushed and killed." Line 742. "Then in turn, Eurycleia, her dear nurse, said to her, 'Kill me then, dear girl, with the pitiless bronze, or else let me be in the halls. I will not hide the story from you. I did know all these things, and I gave him all that he asked for, both bread and sweet wine. But he took a great oath from me never to tell you of it until it came to the 12th day, or until you might miss him yourself or hear he was absent, so that you might not ruin your lovely skin with weeping.'" So poor Eurycleia says, "I couldn't tell you. He made me swear an oath not to." Line 750. "But go, wash with water, and put clean clothing upon your body, and going on to the upper story with your attendant women, pray to Athena, daughter of Zeus of the Aegis, for she would then be able to save him, even from dying. But do not embitter the bitterness of the old man. Don't go bother Laertes. I think the seed of Archaeus is not altogether hated by the blessed gods, but there will still be one left to inherit the high-roofed house and the rich fields that lie at distance." So she spoke, and stilled her grieving, and stopped the weeping of her eyes. And she washed, and put clean clothing upon her body, and went to the upper story with her attendant women, and laid the barley grains in the basket, and prayed to Athena. "Hear me, Atrétene, child of Zeus of the Aegis, if ever here in his own palace resourceful Odysseus burned the rich thigh pieces of an ox or sheep in your honor, remember it now for my sake, and save for me my beloved son, and fend off the suitors who are evilly overbearing." She spoke and raised the outcry, and the goddess listened to her praying. But the suitors, all through the shadowy halls, were raising a tumult, and thus would go the word of one of the arrogant young men. So these are the types of things the suitors were saying. Line 770. "Surely our much-sought-after queen is consenting to marriage with one of us, not knowing how the murder of her son is appointed." Okay, surely she'll approved to marrying one of us, since she doesn't know we're going to murder her son. Thus one of them would speak, not knowing what was appointed. But it was Antinous who now stood forth and addressed them. "You are all mad. Keep clear of this kind of disorderly talk, for fear somebody may go inside and report us. But come, let us silently rise up now and put into action that counsel which has been resolved in the hearts of all of us." So he spoke, and chose out the 20 best men among them, and they went along to the fast ship and the sand of the seashore. And first of all they dragged the ship out to the deepening water, and in the black hull set the mast in place, and set sails and made the oars fast in the leather slings of the oarlocks, all in good order, and hoisted the white sails and set them, and their high-hearted henchmen carried their gear on for them. Line 785. They anchored her deep enough in the channel, and then, disembarking themselves, prepared their dinner and waited for the coming of evening. But she in the upper chamber, circumspect Penelope lay there fasting. She had tasted no food nor drink, only pondering whether her stately son would escape from dying or have to go down under the hands of the insolent suitors. And, as much as a lion caught in a crowd of men turns about in fear when they have made a treacherous circle about him, so she was pondering when a painless sleep came upon her, and all her joints were relaxed so that she slept there, reclining. Line 795. Then the gray-eyed goddess Athena thought what to do next. She made an image and likened it to Penelope's sister, Iphimi, the daughter of great-hearted Icarius, whose husband was Eumelius, and he lived in his home at Pherae. She sent her now into the house of godlike Odysseus in order to stop Penelope, who was grieving, lamenting from her crying and tearful lamentation. The dream figure went into the bedroom, passing beside the thong of the door bar, and came and stood above her head and spoke a word to her. "Penelope, are you sleeping so sorrowful in the inward heart?" Line 805. "But the gods who live at their ease do not suffer you to weep and to be troubled, since your son will have his homecoming even yet, since he has done no wrong in the gods' sight." Circumspect Penelope said to her in answer, sleeping very sweetly now in the dream's gateway, "Why have you come here, sister, now when you were not used to come before, since the home where you live is far away from us, and now you tell me to give over from the grieving and sorrows that are many upon me and trouble me in my heart and spirit, since first I lost a husband with the heart of a lion, and who among the Danaans surpassed in all virtues a great man, whose fame goes wide through Hellas and midmost Argus, and now again a beloved son is gone on a hollow ship, an innocent, all unversed in fighting and speaking, and it is for him I grieve even more than for that other one, and tremble for him in fear," line 820, "lest something should happen to him, either in the country where he is gone or in the wide sea, for he has many who hate him and are contriving against him and striving to kill him before he comes back into his own country." Then in turn, the dark dream image spoke to her in answer. Line 825, we should do a little ooh. "Take courage. Let not your heart be too altogether frightened. Such an escort goes along with him, and one that other men would have prayed to have standing beside them, for she has power, Pallas Athena, and she has pity on you in your grieving, and it is she who has sent me to tell you of these things." Circumspect Penelope said to her in answer, "If then you are a god, and have heard the voice of the goddess, come then, tell me of that other unfortunate. Tell me whether he still lives and looks upon the sun's shining, or whether he's died and is now in the house of Hades." We have to give Penelope credit. As soon as she realizes this is some type of a goddess been sent to her in the night to tell her Telemachus will be okay, her first instinct is to ask about Odysseus. Line 835. Then in turn, the dark dream image spoke to her in answer, "As for that other one, I will not tell you the whole story, whether he lives or has died. It is bad to babble emptily." So she spoke and drifted away by the bolt and the doorpost and out and into the blowing winds. Icarius's daughter started up from her sleep, soothed in the inward heart, because this clear dream in the dim of the night had come to visit her. But the suitors went aboard. So now we're changing scenes again. And this is how, of course, this scene would close. But the suitors went aboard and sailed out into the flowing waves, in their hearts devising sudden death for Telemachus. There is a rocky island there in the middle channel, halfway between Ithaca and towering Samos, line 845, called Asteris, not large, but it has a double anchorage where ships can be hidden. There the Achaeans waited in ambush. And there ends book 4.